Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Let the consequences be what they may, whether the Potomac is crimsoned in human gore, and Pennsylvania Avenue is paved 10 fathoms deep with mangled bodies, or whether the last vestige of liberty is swept from the face of the American continent, the South will never submit to such humiliation and degradation as the inauguration of Abraham Lincoln.
Glass is chilling.
That superb American accent. I mean, I didn't even try and do an Atlanta accent there, but because
have you been to Georgia?
I'll come to that in a minute. That was from the Atlanta newspaper, the Southern Confederacy, in August 1860. I have been to Savannah.
Oh, that's very Georgia.
I've been to Savannah. Yeah. So yes, I have.
But you clearly didn't pick up the local dialect.
No, I didn't, I'm afraid. So many apologies to all Americans from the South who may be listening to this. I put my hands up. I can't do it. I really apologize. But we wanted to read that because it's a kind of the death knell for the peace that it held and the sense of kind of the carnage that is to come. And it's a perfect introduction to part two of the episode we're doing here on The Rest of History on the American Civil War. And in the first part, Adam Smith, great scholar of the period, took us through the causes of the war. And Adam, you took us up to the firing on Fort Sumter and the establishment of the Confederacy with its capital at Richmond. At what point do you think it becomes absolutely clear that there is no way back? Is it the firing on Fort Sumter? That's what's traditionally said, isn't it? Or even after that, might it have been possible to pull back the dogs of war?
No, I don't think so, because by that point, this new Confederacy had this huge burst of self-confidence. You know, they pulled it off. They pulled off what may seem to us to be the most extraordinary thing, to create a new slaveholding republic in the middle of the 19th century, but they'd done it. And what were the chances that the United States, with virtually no standing army, and what army it had was kind of strung out policing the frontier, Native Americans, what chance had they got of subduing militarily an area that's the size of Western Europe? I mean, how are they going to manage that?
So do they think that there simply won't be a war, that people in the North will just accept it?
I think there's definitely many Southerners who hope that, because they have a pretty low opinion of Northerners.
But do they think it?
I think some of them who thought it, yeah. Some of them calculated that the North was too divided, that it was made up of this polyglot. We didn't talk in the last episode about immigration, but that's part of the story here. This big scale immigration of Catholic Irish into New York and Boston, Philadelphia in the 1850s. And Southerners look at this, and there's Germans come in as well. And the Southerners look at this and they think, you know, this polyglot conglomeration of greasy mechanics, you know, they don't know how to handle a gun. They've got no clue. They've got no capacity. There's no political will. So they're not going to be able to fight us. But if there is a war, there'll be one great climactic Napoleonic-style battle, and clearly we'll win it, and it'll be job done.
But Adam, I mean, the question that always has been on my mind is why, and I mean, a lot of Americans will say, oh, it's obvious, but I would say to an outsider, to a non-American, it's not obvious. Why do the Northerners hate slavery? They think slavery is corrupting. They think the South is sunk in sin, is steeped in sin. Why don't the Northerners just let the South go? I mean, why don't they just say, okay, sod you. Set up your tin pot Confederacy. We've got, you know, billions more factories than you. We're much more prosperous. We're much more productive. We're not corrupted by slavery. You'll sink like a stone, and then you'll come begging to us in 10 years, please, can we come back into the Union? I mean, why don't they do that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a question I've been asking for 20 years, actually, Dominic. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is the question. Because I think the other side of it, which is not hard for me to explain why Southerners wanted to secede. There's a lot much more being written about that question. And to me, it's not really a mystery at all. I think they're absolutely, given their own, given the situation they were in by 1860, I think they were quite right to roll the dice. And
the Southerners.
The Southerners, yeah. I mean, it turned out really, really badly for them. But I think I can totally see why, given the election of Lincoln, there were going to be a lot more Republican presidents potentially where he came from, given the shifting demographics, given the electoral system. And it's really hard to maintain an oppressive system of human enslavement. You've got to know that the polity that you are existing in respects and is going to uphold the idea of property in human beings. And if you've got a president of your country who doesn't believe that property in human beings is legitimate, that's really, really bad. So, it made complete sense. Now, there were lots of reasons why, but hang on, the enslaved people can still escape across to the north, and then you won't have the Fugitive Slave Act to get your property as you think of it returned. But then they're saying, well, that wasn't working anyway. So what have you lost, really? So it makes complete sense why Southerners wanted to secede. But your question, why then did Northerners respond to secession with a war to save the Union, is a right one. After all, I mean, what would we do if when Scotland votes for independence? Are you going to join up to fight for the Union? Perhaps you will, Tom. I don't know. I think you've written quite passionately on this.
Yeah, Tom has got, I mean, I've been to Tom's house. He's got a whole room full of stuff, like ready to go. He's got like disguises. What,
artillery?
Yeah,
artillery.
He's got it all.
Well, actually, We've got a house on the north bank of the Tweed, just inside Scotland, so it'll be a bridgehead. Fort Sumter.
But yeah, I mean, obviously there's your example, Adam, right?
Anyway, I've not answered your question here. Let me try and answer your question. Some people did say that. Let the Erring Sisters depart in peace. It was a headline in the New York Tribune. I mean, there was that sentiment. But why not? Because in the end, the point is this: the United States is the last best hope of Earth. That's Abraham Lincoln's phrase. It is, and just think about that. This is the last refuge for humanity. If the experiment in democracy of constitutional government is seen to fail,
yeah.
If the response to a duly constituted election is that half of the country or almost half of the country throws its toys out of the pram and walks out, then the light of freedom will dim around the world.
But also a house divided against itself cannot stand. So if half the house goes, then there's a risk the whole house may collapse.
So that's Lincoln. Lincoln made that speech, didn't he? I think in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, that a house divided itself can't stand. That's right, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I mean,
1858. Yeah.
Why don't, if the house so patently is divided, why not just cut off the bit that's the problem, the rotten bit, as it were, and the rest of your house is going to be fine? I mean, that would be my argument. In some ways, if you're a Northerner, you might well say, listen, we're a lot better off without those clowns. They're bad people. They've got slaves. You know, they're backward. Because that's what a lot of Northerners thought about the South, right? They thought they were backward and kind of fly-bitten and all this sort of stuff. I mean, I would say it still is quite baffling that you're prepared to lose, what is it, more than 300,000 Northerners die mm-hmm. in the Civil War to force these people to be back in their country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you've got, I agree. I think it is baffling. It's something I've been struggling with for 20 years. I mean, you have American listeners. They can write in and tell you why us three Brits asking this question, what we're missing and why it's all so ludicrous that we're even asking the question. But the answer must have something to do with the idea of the Union. And
yeah,
what it must do. Promise of the revolution and the Declaration of Independence represents.
I mean, it's kind of very on brand now to sneer at the idea that there was a kind of moral imperative behind the Union in the Civil War, that it's couched in overtly cynical terms. And yet this, I can't understand why they would have done it unless a certain sense of kind of an identification of their cause with what was best, not just for the North, but for the United States and for the whole of the world,
yes,
was in
exactly.
play.
No,
I mean,
it's... Yes, you've put that very well. That's exactly what they said repeatedly, and I think that's exactly what they thought. I mean, the flip side of that was the humiliation they said they felt, how diminished they felt on the world stage as a result of secession. That this was a necessary project in order, the fiery trial through which they now had to pass was necessary in order to prove themselves as a real nation on the global stage.
Adam, we've been talking about it so far as though North and South are absolutely distinguishable, or as though in effect they have become two separate countries. But of course, we call it the American Civil War, and that implies, you know, institutions and even families being divided. And I suppose an obvious institution that does end up divided would be West Point, which is the great U.S. military academy, where large numbers of graduates and officers who commanding heights of the U.S. Army have to decide which of the two sides they're going to go for. And I suppose the emblematic figure who has to make his mind up is perhaps the most famous general of all, perhaps from Ulysses S. Grant, which is the guy who ends up leading the Confederacy, Robert E. Lee. So what's his background? How does he come to choose the Confederacy over the Union? Because he actually gets offered the leadership of the Union, doesn't he?
He does, because he's regarded as one of the most able officers in the United States Army in 1860-1861. He is a career Army officer, but he's a Virginian. We mentioned him in the last episode. He was the guy who arrested John Brown when Brown launched his raid on Harper's Ferry in Virginia to try to distribute the guns from that arsenal and set off a slave insurrection. So, you know, the story about Lee that has been told down the generations and that is much cherished by, you know, has been much cherished, still is, by white Southerners, is that he was in an agony of indecision. You know, what should he do? You know, he's after all, he's an officer of the United States, so he's sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. But in his heart, he's a Virginian, and he's completely divided on what's he going to do. In the end, he can't bring himself to lead an army of invasion into his home state. That's the story that's told about Robert E. Lee. Well, I think that what that undersells is the extent to which Lee, like other elite white Virginians, was fundamentally committed to slavery.
Well, because his wife owns large numbers of plantations, right?
Yeah.
And slaves.
And yes, he's fully married into, he's part of a Virginia dynasty that has owned slaves for generations. He temperamentally, culturally, intellectually, politically, he loathes everything that this new insurgent radical Republican, people would probably call it, like him, the Black Republican Party represents. He's just no way that Robert E. Lee was ever going to be comfortable leading the Union Army.
Right. Because it's an important part of his brand that he gets compared to a perfect British gentleman by British Observer during the war. He's a kind of silver fox. He's very stylish.
Well, that's the Confederacy's cool brand, though, Tom. I mean, Confederacy's brand. I mean, I read in my children's history book that I read in the 1970s, that was the Confederacy's brand.
And so that's why that
could have Cavaliers.
Yeah, and that is why Lee is the kind of I mean, he's in a sense the Prince Rupert of the Confederacy. He's the dashing cavalier. He's the emblem of it. But in essence, he is doing it because he wants to keep his children's inheritance safe. And that inheritance consists of plantations and of human property.
Yeah. And the vision of America that he understands, and that he understands he's inherited from his ancestors who fought in the Revolution, is one that fundamentally includes slavery. And as it were, why shouldn't it? Because that's what the Republic has always done. And so he's standing against revolution, as he sees it. I mean, he could not conceive that a United States run by these new Republicans was going to be one that he would recognize. His world is about to end if the Republicans' vision for America dominates.
And let's sort of pull back the camera back a bit. So by the summer of 1861, you have, I think, 11 states in the Confederate States of America. They've got a population of 9 million people. 3.5 million of them or so are slaves. And they are against 22 states in the Union. So the rump Union, if you like, are USA, I suppose you would call them, with 22 million people, but massive advantages in mills, factories, railroads, and all those things. We know now, everybody listening to this knows that the Union wins. just to go through those facts and figures, it makes it sound like, okay, it's just like playing out a board game. You know, you've got all the cards.
We've got two questions which go together well. One is Grant Rogers. Why did the Union Army lose so many battles at first? Spoiler alert, they do. And Will Randall, did the South stand a chance, or was the North always going to win? So I think those questions kind of go together, really, because it's the fact that the North doesn't win a kind of crushing victory initially that allows the war to go on, but sets up the question of, was the North always going to win?
I think the North was always going to win if it could stay the course. If the war went on long enough for it to bring to bear its advantages in men and material and its diplomatic advantages and its territorial advantages and everything else, if the war went on long enough. But it might not have done. It might have ended earlier than that. So there are scenarios, I think, which we can talk about. We can imagine scenarios short of the total military victory that the North in the end won.
I mean, isn't that the only way they win, though, Adam? With the total military victory? Because all the Confederacy has to do is just somehow plod along and keep going, and they'll eventually win, right? Because the North will settle and then...
So the Confederate objectives are to persuade the North that this isn't a war, that they can win in that total way, that it isn't worth the enormous cost. So therefore, because the United States is a democracy, albeit only with, you know, with men voting and essentially white men voting, but it's subject to public opinion. And so it follows then that logically Confederate military strategy was focused on Northern public opinion. Robert E. Lee got this. You know, he knew that in the end, what he had to do was to persuade ordinary Northern people that this wasn't a war that was worth fighting. Yeah. That's what the South had to do. What the North had to do, as you say, Dominic, is to completely destroy the South. Which in the end was what they did. But it took them 4 years. And it took them 4 years to marshal their superior resources. So by the very end of the war, by the final year of the war, the North was fighting essentially a war of attrition, in which it was pummeling the South day after day after day after day, often losing more men than the South in any given battle.
But they could afford to.
But it could afford to do so.
Yeah. Okay, so Adam, one other way in which people say that the Confederacy, I mean, would have been able to hold out perhaps, is if the European powers, and perhaps particularly Britain, had entered the war on its side. And so you mentioned about the Confederacy sending emissaries to Paris and to London. What would have happened if either the French or the British had come in on the Confederate side? And was there ever any prospect of that happening?
Yeah, so this is kind of always the sort of deus ex machina for the South, right? This notion that there would be some foreign intervention. And after all, they knew how this would work because they could look back to the American War of Independence, right? So there was a war in which a bunch of sort of scrappy colonials with no proper army defeated the world's leading military superpower. I mean, what were the chances of that? Well, one of the ways in which they did it, of course, was with French military help. So they had a template there. Get the French involved again, or get the Brits involved, and all of a sudden you change the military balance. And they had, you know, they had good reason for optimism. I mean, after all, if, and it's obviously a very big if, you take slavery out of the equation, then what the Southerners were doing in 1861 was national self-determination. If you're a British liberal, you know, if you're Gladstone, or more to the point, if you're Richard Cobden, yeah, you look at this and you're kind of, you know, your head explodes because national self-determination, obviously good. Like, what's not to like about that? The Southerners support free trade. They're anti-protectionist. That's obviously good. But on the other hand, they're slaveholders. That's a bit of a problem. So what, you know, British liberals were in this genuine dilemma at the start of the war. But the fact that at the beginning of the war, Lincoln and the Union said, well, this is not a war to end slavery. This is just a war to keep the Union together, meant that there was space in British liberal radical circles to say, well, okay, if this really isn't a war to end slavery, then, and maybe, as you know, as Dominic was saying earlier, maybe actually slavery will come to an end earlier if it's kind of quarantined in this new Confederate. And then we can apply sanctions, we can use economic influence somehow or other, potentially we can blockade them, we can stop imports of new slaves. Maybe slavery can end more quickly.
Yeah, but also, Adam, isn't it the case that you could argue it's in Britain's strategic interest to break up the United States. I mean, there are fears all through the 19th century that there could be war between the United States and British North America, you know, what becomes Canada. So surely, I mean, isn't there an argument from kind of Palmerston and people like that? Mm. Listen, let's pile in, smash it all up. Great for us. We're even more top nation than we were already. The pesky colonials have been taught a lesson.
And it's pretty much what the French are doing in Mexico, right? So we did an episode on the extraordinary French adventure in Mexico.
Yeah.
And that basically is an attempt to try and set up a French zone of influence while the Americans are distracted.
Yeah. Since the French are already militarily engaged in North America and with this bizarre intervention in Mexico, Napoleon III is probably more likely to come in support of the Confederacy in the end than Britain. Everything you say is totally right, Dominic, about the kind of schadenfreude and the kind of gleeful enjoyment of the Americans going to war with one another in 1861. What are the countervailing factors that meant that in the end, I actually kind of, you know, to answer your question, was Britain ever likely to intervene on the part of the Confederacy? I think no is the answer. What were the countervailing factors? Well, one of them was the City of London and the massive amounts of investment that had been made in United States railroads, and that all would have been put at jeopardy if Britain then had to go to war with the United States, which presumably would have been the inevitable consequence of intervention in support of the Confederacy. And the second one in the end was slavery. In the end, as it became clearer and clearer that Union victory in the war would deal likely an irreparable blow to slavery, it became harder and harder to imagine how a British government would do anything to actively support a pro-slavery republic.
Yeah. And that among the liberals, as you say, that, I mean, they can't do it really, can they, deep down?
No.
They can't pile in to support slaveholders. Because although as cynical and as ruthless as lots of liberal politicians are, they are, as Tom would say, they are deeply Christian. And
I think we should take a break at this point. When we come back, I think we should look at the actual course of the war. So we've kind of alluded to the fact that basically it's Confederate successes all the way, and effectively that establishes a stalemate. I hope I've got that right.
Tom, am I not right in thinking, for any listeners who attempted to disappear, you're also going to be talking about cricket?
Possibly, but I don't want to scare any remaining American listeners.
All right, see you after the break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We've been talking about the American Civil War. We've been talking about how it started, why people chose sides, and why Britain did not get involved. Now, Adam, Tom and I were discussing this before we started recording, and the complexity, we are not military historians by any means, and the complexity of the sort of battle narrative, I think our puny minds struggle to
explode.
Yeah, to compute
they'd explode.
So am I right in, are we right in thinking that basically it's a stalemate for the first 18 months or so, in which the Confederates probably win more battles than the Union. Is that about right?
The only problem I have with the word stalemate is that implies there isn't any movement, any territorial gains, and there is. So if you in the Western theatre, I mean, the Union makes some significant gains. I mean, New Orleans falls to, well, the Union Navy plays a key role there in the spring of 1862. Much of the Mississippi Valley is under Union control. So I think stalemate would be an exaggeration. But if you look at the Virginia theater, so the inevitably a lot of the battles were focused on this area between the two capitals, Richmond and Washington. And that was the place that it was easier for news reporters to get to. That was where Robert E. Lee was in by the spring of 62, was put in command of Confederate forces, the Army of Northern Virginia. So that was the kind of, that was the glamour end of the war. And certainly throughout the spring and summer of 1862, it was the Confederates in the driving seat all the way.
So Lee is the kind of the poster boy, but the other poster boy for that is Stonewall Jackson.
Tom loves Stonewall Jackson, Adam.
Well, but
Tom has a very soft spot. Now, I know I don't want to get you cancelled, Tom, because having soft spots for Confederate generals is quite dodgy. But you, I know you have a tendresse for Stonewall Jackson.
Well. So a question from Brad Smith. How should history view figures like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson? We'll come to that when in due course. Mm. I think Stonewall Jackson is kind of an interesting figure, isn't he? Because he's the archetype of the kind of the Confederate general is cavalier,
long hair,
kind of dashing, all that kind of stuff. Stonewall Jackson is slightly made of sterner stuff. I mean, he is a more Cromwellian figure. He is he teaches black children at Sunday school and all that kind of thing. And the fact that he gets the nickname, doesn't he? Because in the very first battle at Bull Run, there's the threat that the Confederate line will give way and he stands still and he's compared to a stone wall. Am I right in seeing him as a kind of distinctive figure, or is he just part of this blur of kind of dashing, morally dubious Confederate generals?
There is something about Stonewall Jackson, isn't there? I mean, my mother-in-law, like you, is a big fan of Stonewall Jackson.
I just to go on the record, I wouldn't describe myself as a big fan. But he does seem an intriguing figure.
He is an intriguing figure. He sucks lemons, I believe, when he goes into battle.
There's been a lot of talk about that, hasn't there, about whether he ate lemons or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And peaches as well, I gather.
Yeah. I've never quite thought about it as he complicates the cavalier roundhead divide, but you're totally right, Tom, that he does, because he's a kind of roundhead figure in a cavalier army, and maybe that's what makes him stand out among Confederate generals. I've never quite thought about it like that before, but I think you're right.
But Adam, is it? I mean, so that the stereotypical view, and actually you get this right at the end of the war. The surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, Ulysses S. Grant, the Union commander, is all kind of muddy and shabby figure, and Robert E. Lee is in his best uniform and a nice hat and all this sort of stuff. And that's the sort of, I mean, that's the 1970s kind of children's book version of the war. And the version that I think a lot of Americans in the 20th century grew up with is that cavalier stuff. I mean, we can get in a later episode, I think, to the lost cause of the Confederacy. Is that all just nonsense? I mean, these are slave owners, these are slave holders, these are people, some of them professional military men. I mean, they're not just sort of simpering Gone with the Wind style fops with big hair, are they?
No, they're definitely not. Whether or not it all falls depends on what you kind of want to do with this cavalier roundhead dichotomy. Because I think, you know, culturally, religiously, temperamentally, there is, I think, some truth in the notion that this is a forlorn, this is a what seems in retrospect to be a forlorn effort by people who are defending a kind of older system of values against a more modern army. So if that's what you mean by the Cavalier Roundhead division, then I think there is some truth to it. But of course, you're right that, yeah, these people are, I mean, the officer class in particular, anyway, in the Army of Northern Virginia are overwhelmingly slaveholders or the sons of slaveholders.
But let's talk a bit about the experience of being a soldier in the American Civil War. So the standard thing that people say, Tom said it right at the beginning of the first episode in his beautiful Karl Marx quotation, was about it as a sort of modern, it's the first modern war. It's a war full of novelty. But that makes it a horrible war, isn't it, as a soldier? I mean, is it too fanciful to see it as a little bit, there's a lot of, it's very First World War at times. There's an awful lot of mud. There is, you're being hit by shrapnel. There's a lot of disease behind the lines. The conditions are horrible. What do the men themselves think of it?
It becomes more and more like the First World War. So if we were transported now to outside Petersburg in Virginia in August 1864, we'd see entrenchments, barbed wire, proto-machine guns. We'd see Union mining engineers tunneling under Confederate lines in order to blow holes underneath in order to try to engineer an advance, just like on the Western Front.
It's also Napoleonic, right, as well, though, because you've got
cavalry,
you've got Custer, you've got Jeb Stuart.
And that's why it's a classic transition war. And so certainly through most of 1861, 62, 63, you wouldn't have seen much or any of that. You would have seen some entrenchments in some places, but you certainly would have seen cavalry charges. And all through, and really right up until the end of the war, this continuing faith that bayonet charges, the kind of cult of the bayonet charge as the great, glamorous, decisive moment that's going
well,
to shift the war.
Let's wait, because we will talk about that in the context of Gettysburg, which perhaps we'll do in the next episode. We've talked about the experience of men in the war. Could we also talk about the experience of women? So one of the things that makes, to go back to my old friend Stonewall Jackson, interesting is that his sister is a very, very keen abolitionist and goes on the Union side. So that's kind of representative, perhaps, of families divided. Is that common? Is there a kind of, is that sense of a gender divide one that is common, or is that distinctive to Jackson's family? And more generally, what is the role that women are playing? Because as I understand it, it's unusually heightened relative to earlier wars, the role that women play.
Yes, women are very involved in both sides, in both sustaining the war effort and in the end in helping to undermine the war effort. So for example, by the summer of 1863, women on the home front in the South who are suffering severe shortages of bread and other basic foodstuffs, and in the context of massive Weimar Germany style inflation, are out on the streets rioting and encouraging desertion from the Confederate Army in some places. But at the same time, they're also the embodiment. Women are projected as being the kind of embodiment of the patriotic cause on both sides. And so as in other modern wars, both the imagined reality of the role that women are playing, but also the actual material reality as nurses and as volunteers and as the people who are sustaining the war effort back home.
Right, so people who are running the farms and things.
Yeah. It's hugely important.
So the men are away from home. They're riddled with disease. A lot of them presumably, prostitution, there must be camp followers with the two armies, Adam?
Yeah. And General Hooker, of course, is supposedly the person who most encouraged or at least turned a blind eye to camp followers. And, his name was attached to some of them.
The word Hooker comes from General Hooker. Well, I've learned something absolutely splendid.
That is fascinating. Okay. when people are not consorting with ladies of the night, of course, what they should be doing is playing cricket. I mean, everyone knows that. And cricket is very, very popular in the United States prior to the Civil War. Where does it all go wrong?
Cricket is the forgotten casualty of the American Civil War. And I'm glad that on this podcast we're going to restore it to its central place. As you will know better than me, Tom, in 1859 there was an England tour of North America. I think they played three matches against a United States 22.
The Americans had twice as many players.
Yeah, they did. And I don't know. I mean, Tommy, presumably they didn't have 22 people actually on the field. They had 22 people batting.
But only 11
fielding. England won all three of those matches anyway. One in New Jersey across the river from New York, one in Boston, one in Philadelphia. And they also played two matches against Upper Canada, I think, on the same tour. And cricket was indeed a very popular summer game. And that England tour really kind of brought it into the public attention, and the New Illustrated Press was all over it. And, yeah, it was a big thing. And fast forward 6 years, the end of the American Civil War, and cricket struggling, and it's never really recovered. I think there was another England cricket tour in 1868, is that right? But it didn't have anything like the same impact as the 1859 tour.
And baseball has taken over, right?
And you know, one of the reasons for this is that baseball is a quicker game.
Yeah.
Also, because it doesn't require.
We can all agree it's basically a children's game, isn't it? I mean, it's a children's game. Let's be frank about it.
Yeah. And it doesn't require, because you don't have to roll out a pitch, because the ball doesn't bounce, does it? When you pitch in baseball, the ball doesn't actually pitch. So therefore, baseball was easier to play in army camps. Where it might have been harder to play cricket. So I do think this is, there are, if you search through the official records of the War of the Rebellion, looking for, which is the huge compilation of all of the reports written by officers throughout the whole of the 4 years of the war, there are a few scattered references to cricket. There were a few cricket games played between regiments, especially in the early year of the war, but it's eclipsed by baseball
as a terrible thing. It's like the cricket tour to France that was projected in 1789. The great events of world history keep getting in the way. so sad. So let's get back to the great events. What happens over the course of 1862? So the very first episode, we had Karl Marx looking at, in awe at the spectacle of these vast armies, kind of ignorant armies clashing by night. What is going on? Just give us a very quick kind of resume of the campaigning.
So in the West, the Union Army is making advances down the Mississippi Valley, capturing New Orleans, which is really critically important.
Because that cuts it in two, right?
It doesn't. It's not fully cut in two until the summer of 1863 when Vicksburg falls. But there's a lot. The Union is making territorial gains in Tennessee and in Arkansas and in Louisiana. Meanwhile, in the East, in Virginia, Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia is kind of running rings around the Union Army. So the first, the first Union commander to make a serious effort to try to win the war is General McClellan, who has this idea that he will kind of float the Union Army down to the James River and advance on Richmond from the east along the peninsula, because he's got this problem. There are all these rivers that are running from eastward, cutting off a direct north-south assault from Washington to Richmond. So this is his clever idea, but he is defeated by General Lee in what are known as the 7 days battles in the summer of 1862. And Lee then audaciously follows up on these important battles in which McClellan's army is pushed back to its original bridgehead on the James River. But instead of then just digging in and defending Richmond, as you might have expected him to do, what Lee then does is to send his troops into Maryland, a slave state, but one that has not seceded. It's basically been held within the Union kind of by force of arms. And this is an incredibly audacious effort, but it goes back to this core objective of the Confederacy that we talked about earlier, which is to persuade the North that this is not a war that in the end they can win.
Because if they can win with this offensive campaign, Adam, the war's been going on for more than a year. Lee presumably thinks if we can lay waste to Maryland, you know, smash the Union armies, the Union will just give up. They'll realize they can't ever beat us.
Yeah. He kind of also hopes as well that Maryland, being a slave state, will kind of rise up in support of the Confederacy, augment his army, and he can then move further from Maryland into Pennsylvania, maybe even into New Jersey. Who knows?
Did he hope to capture Washington itself?
He said, yes. I mean, that was within the... That would have been the, you know, the outside, the most ambitious objective, or at least to encircle Washington, because Washington is very vulnerable, of course, surrounded by slave states. I mean, it's a federal district, which slavery was legal on the eve of the war. It wasn't impossible to imagine that Confederates could have encircled Washington, and that clearly would have been very, very dangerous for the Union.
And the bloodiest of all the battles is Antietam, is that right?
Bloodiest single day. Yes.
The Battle of Towton, of the American history, yes. As I like to think of it.
yes. And that's a battle that, I mean, is essentially a really bloody draw.
And so that's very First World War.
Well, except it was a battle in a day. That isn't so First World War, is it?
All right, okay.
General Lee, they had this incredible stroke of bad luck, which is that Confederate battle plans were lost by a dispatch rider and picked up by a Union spy. And so General McClellan, the Union commander, actually knew exactly where the Confederate army was going to be. It gave them a huge advantage. Even so, it was less than a fully decisive Union victory, but it still stopped this kind of sense of kind of awe-inspiring inevitability of dramatic Southern victories, because Antietam was definitely not that.
Yeah.
And as a result of it, Lee's army retreated back into Virginia.
But the other big result of it, I guess, is that, so we talked about Abraham Lincoln a lot before, and we haven't talked about him so much in this episode, but all this time Lincoln has been chafing, hasn't he? Because he wanted McClellan, his commander, to wage a much more sort of total war. McClellan was sort of wittering about fighting a war on Christian principles and being kind to people and stuff and not attacking.
Hearts and mind strategy.
Yeah, which obviously Lincoln thought was a complete dead loss, didn't he? Because Lincoln is much more clear-sighted. But Lincoln, you mentioned before, Lincoln had said at the beginning, it's not a war to end slavery. I mean, an extraordinary thing to say when we look back at it now, when we think of the war as a war to end slavery. So has Lincoln been itching for an opportunity for one victory so that he can change the terms of the war? Or do you think, Adam? Or does he issue, because he comes to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing slaves, does he do that in desperation, or does he do that because he's always wanted to do it?
He has always wanted slavery to end, but it's not that he had a clear plan in his mind from the outset of hostilities. If, let's just imagine, McClellan had been a better general, or General Lee had been a worse general, and the Peninsula campaign in the spring of 1862 had been successful, and Richmond had fallen in May or June or July of 1862. And let's just imagine that if that happened, that was such a morale blow to the South that several Southern states said, okay, the game's up, let's rejoin the Union. If that had happened and somehow the war had come to an end then, slavery still would have existed, and Lincoln would have had to put up with that. More than put up with that, Lincoln would have regarded that as a great political victory. His struggle against slavery no doubt would have continued.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have changed his mind about slavery. But the war could easily have come to an end if it had saved the Union, or could have come to an end if there'd been a way of saving it while slavery remained intact. Lincoln said as much in terms in a letter he wrote to a Northern newspaper editor, Horace Greeley, in which he said, if I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing some of them and leaving others alone, I would do that. If I could save the Union by without freeing any slaves, I would do that too.
So the Union genuinely matters more to him.
What he is doing is saving the Union. Now, the thing is, when he wrote that letter, though, he had already written and signed a draft of the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, but he'd locked it in his desk drawer. He hadn't made it public. So even while he's saying, everything I do to save the Union, he knows the way this is going. And the reason why he hadn't, this is in the summer of in July, August 1862. And the reason why he hadn't made the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation public at that point was precisely because, as you just said, Dominic, it might be perceived as desperation.
Right.
And then maybe it would be counterproductive. Maybe then it would actually convince European powers that, oh my God, if they're needing to do this, then the Union is really on the back foot. And so perhaps actually the Confederacy is in an even stronger military position than we'd thought. So his Secretary of State, William Seward, basically advises Lincoln to hold off on making the proclamation public until the Union wins a victory. And they kind of win a victory in September at Antietam in Maryland, which you've just been talking about. And so it's on the back of that that Lincoln issues this preliminary Emancipation Proclamation.
And we were saying before that lots of people were abolitionists and yet were very racist. And of course, there are lots of people in the North who probably aren't abolitionists, or the, I mean, as so often in history, there are probably lots of people who couldn't care less about slavery one way or the other. Are they alarmed by such a revolutionary? I mean, given everything we talked about in the first episode, this torturous, grueling argument about the future of slavery, and suddenly Lincoln is like, bang, right, that's it. Through executive action, I am emancipating all the slaves.
Getting abolitionism done.
Yeah, let's get abolitionism done. He's on his bloody Boris thing, smashing through the polystyrene blocks. Are there not people who say, oh my God, what a usurpation of executive power, how he shouldn't have done this? Or have they all become so radicalized by the war that they don't care anymore?
No, there are loads of people saying exactly that, in exactly that language. He's politically very, very divisive. And of course, he does it just before the midterm elections, in which the Republicans then lose a bunch of seats to the Democrats in the North and lose some key. The New York governorship, for example, is won by a Democrat who's opposed to the emancipation policy. He's not really getting emancipation done, though, anyway. What he's actually saying in the September preliminary Emancipation Proclamation is, if this war is still going on the 1st of January 1863, in 3 months' time, if the southern states are still pretending that they're outside of the Union, then at that point I will regard enslaved people in those areas still in rebellion as free. That's what he's actually... So what he's not doing is to free... I mean, there are, in fact, when it comes to it, some tens of thousands of enslaved people who are directly freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. But in fact, what he's doing is declaring free those slaves who are not in Union control and not freeing those slaves who are in Union control. And there are still, after all, four states where slavery is legal that are still in the Union, four border slave states.
So Jefferson Davis, who is the president of the Confederacy, and his pals, how do they react to this? I imagine with ecstatic joy.
They regard it as the most dastardly thing ever done in the long annals of human warfare. That the levels of despicable desperation on display by this emancipation policy appalls them. It is their ultimate nightmare. It's everything they've always feared about this Jacobinical Black Republican Party.
And so presumably that makes their determination to fight on even more resolute.
Yeah, because there can be no
settlement. Likewise,
now, right?
It gives to the Union, to those fighting from conviction for the Union, a sense that they are engaged in what we might call a crusade.
Yes.
And so therefore it sets us up for 1863, which in many ways is the kind of the fulcrum of the entire war, which I think we should look at in our next episode.
Tom, I thought you were going to ask another question, but actually that was a beautiful segue into the end of the episode. It's very nice.
Shall I carry on?
This is for broadcast. I'm complimenting you.
Oh, okay. All right. That's very kind. Okay. Well, on that, as Dominic described it, beautiful ending, we will end. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.